to you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also be hearing John, KC2WGB. John and Dick attempt to organize this group that meets most Sunday evenings. Our main purpose is to educate each other about the 26 different kinds of ham radio, how all this hardware really works, how to make it work better, how to understand it all. Lots and lots to learn about wireless equipment. The schools do only a mediocre job of teaching that. The TechNet itself, in the past, you've been able to look at almost all of the past TechNets by going to the website that records them all. Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has a website that's called, it's under the URL of amateurradio.tangovictor. I believe there's a little bit of an error with that website over the last week and a half or so, and hopefully Mike will get a chance to correct it. So that website right now, I think, is not working. But under normal circumstances, you can review all the past recordings of all of the TechNets, and they're in one-hour reels. You download each one of the one-hour reels and then play it back. Let me drop. For people who can't stay up as late as this TechNet usually lasts, this net usually starts at 8 o'clock and lasts until midnight. And this is the 30th year of this TechNet. When it first began, way back in September of 1982, Hip and I, into FDJ, we used to believe that we'd answer everybody's questions and dry up in a week, in a month or so. Here we are 30 years later. This is TechNet number 1441, if I got the numbers correct. And I may have missed somewhere along the line. Most TechNets, there's at least 51 of them per year. Occasionally we miss one on one of the weekends. The TechNet itself tries to tap into this huge brain power that we know exists in the tri-state area of northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York, and Long Island. There's a lot of wireless brain power in there. So hopefully, as various questions get asked, someone will chime in and say, yes, I've got some experience in there, and this is the this is what I learned over the years. Not everything here is going to be 100% accurate. It's a little bit of a peer-reviewed journal, so to speak, in that when we occasionally make mistakes, as we do, the price is right, but still, mistakes are there, no matter how sincere the people are. Hopefully somebody will come forward in the weeks after that, listen to the recording or listen to the live report and report by email, snail mail, voice, or whatever to John and I that, hey, you guys got it wrong. So that occasionally happens. Everybody has to admit that they've got a batting average. Nobody bats 1,000, if you know what I mean. You can be the most sincere engineer, technologist, scientist, whatever, teacher, and you can think everything you're going to do is going to be absolutely 100% accurate. You'll never achieve that. We have to admit that. And when we do, we go forward and do the best we can. So, no guarantees. The way the TechNet runs, let me drop. The way the TechNet runs is that we take sign-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just to tell us you're listening. After 30 years, we believe somebody is listening. By way of EchoLink and IRLP, apparently this net is also being repeated in various places around the world, at least and we know in Canada and California, among other places, it's being repeated and transmitted live, and people do listen into it. So by now we know that somebody is listening. So if you do have a question or a comment, sign in. John and I make you a partial promise that we try to answer all of those questions during the first hour by giving people at least a brief answer. At the end of the first hour, John goes to the mailbag where people who don't yet have their ham license or don't have range to get into us with live question and answer, they give him an email, snail mail, or whatever. And by that means we take questions of a general nature. John and I are not promising a free consulting service written that people are going to get during the rest of the week. This is the 4 hours we put in each Sunday night is more than enough dedication for two retired guys. And you may think that John and I sound like we've got a great big pile of books alongside of us and a staff of experts, and that's how we're getting all these answers. Not at all. Let me drop. Excellent. happening is that John and I are the exact same age. We both started at around 12 or so years of age with an interest in wireless. I got my license at age 16. I'm not quite sure when John got his first license, but we've spent 60 or so years of our life interested in radio. Our ears would perk up whenever anyone discusses that particular subject, so we've been gathering information all of that time. So because we're old, that's what you're hearing. You're hearing hopefully, the voice of experience. Not because we're so super smart. We're not. We know we make errors. Okay. At this time, I'll take check-ins, and the way the check-in would sign would be something like this. N2EO, Rich and Yes. And Rich just recently came out of the hospital, and that's the way he would sign in if he had a question or a comment to make. So give me your call letters, name, and that yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes. K2MU, Bernie, yes.
KD2CMQ, Neil, yes.
And Dirk Sheehan, I would like you to continue your theory of the electromagnetic wave, which you stopped for a moment. Extremely exciting, and I believe very much intriguing. And Dirk Sheehan.
Okay, very fine. So far we've got Joe, Ernie, Neil, and Wes in that order. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters, name, and by the way, you guys did a good job signing in this time. Call letters and name, and the word yes, just like you're supposed to. So give me your call letters, name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment, and do so right now. K2RIW.
Doing website contact. Harry's website.
One last call. Anyone else just to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters right now.
Big N2EO.
Okay, Rich recognized N2EO. And we'll get to you right after that, Rich, after this list. So, Joe, W-H-Y-Y. How are things going in your neighborhood, Joe? K2RIW listening.
Very good, Dick. Very good, W-H-Y-Y. I'd like to know the advantages and disadvantages, if you happen to know, of what's called a Carolina Wyndham antenna. Back to you.
Yeah, I only know a little bit about it because a buddy of mine built one in our younger days. To my knowledge, it is an off-center fed dipole-like structure which has only one wire going to it. The advantage is that it's a fairly simple antenna. In other words, it has some of the properties of a fan dipole. It works on multiple frequencies. One simple wire of a specific length, I believe, feeding it off-center. And it works on a number of bands simultaneously. That's about as much as I know of a Carolina Wyndham. Simple, multiple bands, medium good performance, dipole-like, if it's mounted high enough. Now, John, I wonder if you've ever built or know anyone who's built a Carolina Wyndham. I wonder if anyone else has specific experience. I've never built one. My buddy, W-H-R-J-B, Rob Nielsen, way back in 1957, he did build one, and he was reasonably happy with it. But Rob's no longer a ham, I'm happy to find. He let his ham license drop. He and I worked together, and that's how we both got our license, by taking a trip down to the FCC headquarters in New York City way back in February of 1956, way back in the old days. So, anybody with Carolina Wyndham experience, please come forward and tell us whatever you know, even if you heard it third hand. Give me a call letters right now, K2RIW.
Interesting. Question. The Carolina Wyndham antenna is not really one wire. Or I just completely confused. You have a 25 feet one side, you have a 41 feet the other one, you have a balloon 4 to 1. You have a 10 feet of RG58, you have a line insulator, which is the choke, and a coax choke to the transceiver. Where do you see over there one wire?
anything west of what you're describing is the more modern version of the Carolina Wyndham. A version that was quasi-popular, at least it was built by my buddy way back in 1956, was fed with one single wire. In other words, from the transmitter point of view, it looked like a long wire antenna. But at the other end of that long wire was this unequal thing that you just described, 25 feet on one side, 41 feet on the other side. That was the embodiment, the way that people built it way back in the 50s. At least that was my recollection. That's the way my buddy did build it, and he was reasonably happy with the performance. So the techniques by which you use other matching techniques with balance and other kinds of transmission lines, a little bit like the G5RV, the Lou Varney type of multiband antenna, that makes more sense, and I think we're discussing now a later version of it. That's my first guess. I wonder if anyone on frequency remembers the earlier version. And so maybe we don't have to go back to the earlier version. The earlier version probably was harder to feed and a little bit less in performance. And I'm guessing the later version is a better way to go. I wonder if you have built one, Wes, and I wonder if you know anyone who has, and are they happy with its performance, and which of the ham bands does it work on? N2XJN, K2RIW.
I'm in also, Dick.
Very fine, John. Wes first, and then John in that order. Go ahead, Wes. And Wes, don't go on to too many other subjects now. Just the Carolina Wyndham. You got it, Wes.
No, I did not. I just happened to know just a little about that. It is 22 feet vertical component of the Carolina between the 4-to-1 matching voltage transformer and the current choke balloon, and is the vertical antenna fitted at the tip. My question to you, before you go to John, is, maybe I give you a few more information. The other short of 22 feet long vertical radiator coax, which could be RG8, whatever. And so yes, radiates to the fill in the gap between the signal pattern radiated by the top portion of it. It is a sort of omnidirectional antenna, as I remember, and you've got to correct me in that. It works sort of good in 40 meters and 80 meters. 160 meters is, I believe, the best. It does not perform over 40 meters. That's what I know about it. I imagine that this sort of effective because the large portion of the RF energy is radiated much at the low angles omnidirectionally. It's sort of efficient because no RF energy is lost in lossy ground system. But my question to you is, if you could recall the original antenna of this sort, doesn't have to be exactly the Wyndham antenna, the Carolina version of it, how then the wire, one wire was connected? Was it plugged to the central wire of the connector, then nothing to the ground? I mean, I'm trying to imagine that. Andrea.
Yeah, the Wyndham of the early days, as I remember, was a little bit from the transmitter point of view like a long wire. In many of the long wire antennas, you could say that the transmission line, a single wire, you could say is connected to the center conductor of the transmitter output, and a short piece of coax, of course, was usually being used, and the shield of the coax went to a grounding system. And depending on how complete you want to make it, a grounding system could be as simple as a grounding rod. And many people have run a long wire antenna with a simple grounding rod for one wire and a center conductor going to the real radiator system. With a broad enough band of antenna tuner nowadays, that can be made to work rather well. The unsymmetric dipole itself, 22 feet on one side, 25 feet on one side, 41 feet on the other side, really is a kind of a dipole-like thing. you don't need to feed a dipole with two wires. If I was feeding the outer tip of a dipole, and it doesn't even have to be half wavelength long if I've got enough impedance matching range of my antenna tuner. So it's hard to believe that a dipole itself will radiate no matter where you feed it, as long as it's impedance matched, and no matter how you resonate it. As long as you resonate it, you'll get dipole-like performance. And whether or not the piece of wire going up to it or the transmission line with the 4-to-1 Balun and the impedance matching devices, whether or not that is also radiating, is a function of a lot of variables. So are you radiating some of the vertically polarized signal by way of the transmission line, as well as horizontal polarization by the dipole-like structure? All of the above can take place. Ain't simple, but as long as you can form resonance electronically, you can get
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Dick, was it the Zip-type antenna, the original Windom, the Zip-type, which was sort of the 14% of the center, and the single wire?
There used to be something called NFED Zip, which is a kind of a long wire antenna. Zip antenna, I'm not quite sure. Let's see what John's experience is on all of the above. I wonder if you remember the old Windom that was fed with one piece of wire. And maybe it's a faulty memory on my part, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2GJE.
GJE recognized, and we'll get to you after John. Okay. Go ahead, John.
Oh, your description is almost right on, Dick. Perfect. In 1972, a friend of mine, Joe, was using two of them at 90 degrees apart, and he did feed them with a single wire, had a Balun, but also in the shack, he had to have a Balun, and it was fed with a counterpoise of a ground rod. Both of them were common to that one ground rod. He used it for about 2 years. He did fairly well with it. Then he wound up going to a loop antenna, which performed a little better. But you're right on with the original Windom, as far as I know. And I saw it. Ugly-looking thing, but it worked.
Would you be able, John, to confirm if that antenna works only 40 meters down, not 40 meters up?
If you happen to know what frequencies it was claimed to work on and what frequencies your buddy did use it on, John, go ahead.
Yes, Dick. He was using it on 20 meters through 80. Of course, 160 didn't perform at all, but he was pretty fortunate to have it work on that band from 20 to 80.
With the right kind of a balancing device, antenna tuner. And not many people used antenna tuners way back in the early days of ham radio because all of our tube-type transmitters, like a Heathkit DX100 or your Collins rigs or whatever, they all had a PI output network. You had a tuning control, a loading control, and sometimes a switch that would tap into the inductor of the PI network. And those PI networks used to have an extremely large tuning range. As long as you had the right phase angle of the reflected signal because of a high-vis wire antenna, in many cases, that PI network that was popular in those days, these weren't no-tune transmitters. These were very tune-required transmitters. But I suspect that many of them would tolerate a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio in many cases. Ed, I know you wanted to add something to this. Tell us your experience with Windom. K2GJE in Bohemia, I think. K2RIW. Go ahead, Ed.
You're right, and I'm in Bohemia. Handle is Ed. This is K2GJE. The Windom, as I remembered, was either an 80-meter half wave or a 40-meter half wave based upon how much property you had, fed one-third off an end with 300 ohm twin lead, which was very available in the 50s. It was usually fed from a balanced antenna tuner, which we would make ourselves. And as far as I know, it was a combination of radio. radiation off the twin lead and the flat top, and it worked from whatever you cut it to and up. If you cut it at 80, it worked on 40, 20. The SWR varied, but it did get out quite well, and we would have these usually in the 50s, these homemade antenna tuners where we would tap the coil equally each side and then set it with one loop. Back to net.
Hi, thank you, Ed. And it sounds like you guys maybe didn't use much of a balun at the antenna in those days. And so without a balun at the antenna, when you feed any dipole-like structure off of center, there will be common mode voltage. And that requires a little bit of explanation. When you're feeding twin lead, just to make a simple example out of it, if I'm feeding twin lead in only the differential mode, at one instant of time, the right-hand wire is plus 1 volt, we'll say, and the left-hand wire is minus 1 volt on the first half cycle. And on the second half of that first cycle, those two polarities get reversed. But positive and negative are always balanced equal to each other. If you're feeding twin lead-like transmission line in the thoroughly differential mode, if I was feeding it in the thoroughly common mode, I would at one instant of time put plus 1 volt on the right-hand side of the twin lead and the left-hand side of the twin lead simultaneously on the first half of the cycle. On the second half of the cycle, I'd be putting minus 1 volt on right side and left side of the twin lead simultaneously. That's thoroughly common mode feeding. So you now know what differential mode. Differential mode is sort of like a seesaw. Right side is going up, left side is going down, and then the other half cycle you reverse. Sort of like a seesaw is differential mode. Common mode would be if Arnold Schwarzenegger walked over there to your horizontal seesaw, and at the pivot point he picks it up and then he pulls it back down, if you know what I mean. He's picking up the center of the seesaw and pushing it back down. That's common mode. As you can see, if you're now smart enough, you could with a parallel line twin lead like on the drop. If you're feeding open wire line or twin lead like transmission line, and if you've got the right kind of a impedance matching, antenna tuner, balancing device, if you've got the right kind of devices, you can decide to feed your antenna in the differential mode, you can decide to feed it in the common mode, and you can slide halfway between the two. You can have a seesaw that's tipping left and right at the exact same time Arnold Schwarzenegger is holding that pivot in the middle and he's raising his hands up and down. You can do the combination. And those are the exact experiments that Mel, K2KEY, was doing near the time that he became a silent key. He had been running a series of experiments on a full-wave loop antenna. He found out he had a particular pattern when he fed it in the pure common mode. He had an entirely different pattern when he fed it in the differential mode. He was changing pattern, changing polarization of what he was radiating in various directions, depending on the state of the ionosphere. When he's talking to his buddy in London, so to speak, he could slide back and forth between parallel mode, between the differential mode and the common mode of feeding the open wire line to his loop antenna. He could therefore adjust pattern and polarization, not necessarily independently, but he was simultaneously adjusting pattern and polarization by changing the method by which he was feeding the antenna. So almost all of our antennas, if you want to use the transmission line, particularly open wire line, as a partial radiator, if you've got the right kind of electronics that can slide between differential mode and common mode, there are times when you've got other knobs on your transmitting network, if you know what I mean, which can give you different advantages. I tried explaining that to a number of people who were present. Let me drop it. There were some very important people who shall remain nameless that were present at the awards dinner, the awards luncheon, back in 2010 when the, was it 2012, I guess it was, 11, not even sure of the year, when the TechNet was being given the ARRL Board of Directors Award for, all of a sudden I can't even say it, I'm going to have to walk over and look on the wall the name of the award, but for the TQ shocking experience the TechNet was given. We got an award, and I was explaining at that time to a number of people what was going on with K2KEY. Bell was doing these experiments with differential mode and common mode. I tried explaining that to people by moving my hands, right hand up, left hand down, and reversing, and then moving both hands up and down simultaneously to try to get across the concept of common mode feeding or differential mode feeding of open wire line of antennas like Wyndham, antennas like Loop, and whatever. Unfortunately, maybe I was doing it too fast, didn't do it right. The people I was talking to just gave me a blank stare and didn't understand it. You guys now are a little bit smarter. You're hearing it for the first time, maybe. You're going to hear it a few more times. You'll eventually know the difference between differential mode and common mode. And when it comes to feeding the Wyndham, I suspect having the ability to do that can change its performance, can change its pattern, can change its polarization. And it's just one more knob that once you're smart enough to know to create that knob, you can use it, turn it, so to speak, and get other performance out of your antenna. Over to you, Joe. I know that we didn't answer your question directly, but hopefully we gave you a little bit of information. We claim that this is an educational experience. The price is right, Joe. The P2LYY, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, you're feeding this antenna with a piece of coax cable of a certain length, and it goes up to a, some sort of ballon assembly or choke assembly, and then it goes vertical from there, so many feet. But at the point you're feeding it from coax from your transmitter, do you have to ground that point into a ground rod right at that point, or can you ground your coax outside of your house as the transmission line leaves your premise? Where would you say is the best point for grounding it? I'm talking about to make the antenna perform correctly, so you don't have, you know, something you can't tune correctly.
If you've got enough antenna tuning range of your antenna tuner, every antenna in the world that's a few inches long to a few thousand feet long, with all possible orientations, you can force it into resonance, you can force it to tune, and from the transmitter point of view, you can make the standing wave ratio as low as you like. So there's no magic along those lines. To my knowledge, most of these antennas of the type similar to the Luvani antennas, the G5RV, where various versions of it have some length of twin lead, some length of coax cable, sometimes with and without balance in various places feeding the antenna, and you get multi-band performance by occasionally using the horizontal portion of the antenna as the major radiator, occasionally having some radiation from the transmission line system. None of these antennas, to my knowledge, Joe, require significant grounding downrange of the beginning of your coax transmission line. To ground the transmission line at the shack, where it leaves the house, so to speak, yes, for lightning protection reasons, among other reasons, many of us will ground at that point. Almost none of these antennas require any further grounding downrange, and because some guys have the ability to mount the antenna good and high in the air, every bit of the coax and open wire portion of the feeding system could be purely vertical. And for anybody to talk about creating a ground in the middle of a transmission line that goes up the side of a tower, so to speak, almost nobody does that. And the word ground in that case would have some mysterious meanings. I mean, if I'm on the third floor of an apartment building and I want to create a local ground, that ain't easy. Because ground usually means earth, good connection to earth, and I'm sitting 30 feet above that earth in the third floor.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the third floor balcony, I'm sitting up there 30 or 40 feet in the air, and I could call something ground, and there is a procedure by which you can do something called a tuned ground. I think there are companies that will give you a tuned ground. In other words, you create a piece of wire between your balcony 30 feet up and the grounding rod outside of the apartment building, directly below you. And if you tune that piece of wire correctly with the right kind of impedance matching network, you can create the equivalent of a ground at the third floor. However, that piece of wire will be RF hot. And It will be part of your radiating system whether you know it or not. Even though, if you do the grounding correctly, the amount of RF voltage at your shack of the shield of the transmission line compared to the rest of the universe, you can make the shield voltage go to zero. But that wire somewhere in the middle of it will have voltage on it. So the word ground is very relative when it comes to RF. When it comes to microwave, can you imagine at 10 gigahertz where the wavelength is 1 inch and your particular transmitter is, let me pick a number, 20 feet above the ground and you want to ground something? RF-wise, there ain't no such thing as ground. Lucky those people tend to use things like waveguide and everything shielding and the RF, where everything is shielded and the RF is flowing down the center of it. So, I can tell that we haven't answered the Carolina Wyndham latest version, what is really going on. I can tell a little bit more research is required, Joe. Let me pass it over to the group and see if anybody has any further experience about what's now called Carolina Wyndham with the modern feeding techniques. And once again, I'll repeat that there's nothing magic about feeding the center of a dipole. You can feed it anywhere you want from the outer edge toward the center, as long as you have the right kind of impedance matching device and RF choke.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So once again, you can feed it anywhere along the dipole you want to, and the dipole doesn't even have to be exactly resonant in physical length, but you can feed it anywhere you want to if you get the right kind of impedance matching device, RF choking and or balancing device. You can feed it anywhere you want, because your final radiating system is really a kind of a flywheel. RF energy is going to be bouncing back and forth in that radiating system, no matter what it is, with the exception of a rhombic antenna or a beverage antenna, which has a terminating resistor at the far end. With the exception of those two very rare kinds of antennas, every one of the antennas we all use are what's called a standing wave structure. Fancy way of saying that within the radiating system, a hell of a lot of energy is bouncing back and forth. Inside of it, there is an extremely high standing wave ratio, typically 20 to 1 on all the antennas we use. I'm not saying that's what you see at the feed point of the transmission line, but somewhere in the antenna, energy is bouncing back and forth. That gives you a current multiplication, a voltage multiplication, and that's what really creates 90-some-odd% of the radiation. That current multiplication gives you a stronger magnetic field and starts off the process. That's what some of the discussions that I and Glenn, KCQQIQ, have been having, and I at least am slowly coming to that conclusion of where radiation really takes place. So there is a resonating structure like a flywheel. And once you decide to build a flywheel, let me drop. Because that's the nearest analogy I can think of what the radiating system is. It's like a flywheel, and you can decide to use a push rod to push back and forth somewhat like the way you transmit power to the main wheel of a locomotive or a railroad engine. That rod can be near the pivot point or near the outer perimeter. That's just a higher or lower impedance, so to speak. Or you can feed it by way of the circular shaft, and you're creating torsional energy. There's lots of ways you can put energy into the radiating system. Very similar to moving your feed point from center out to one side or all the way out to the outer edge of a dipole. So that's the one thing in common with all of these systems. It will be electronically resonated at your desired frequency. Hope this helps a little bit, Joe. I know we've got to dig a little bit more into the Wyndham, because I don't think we've got all the information here yet. WQRYY, the guy who asked this question, KQRYW in the TechNet.
WY to you.
Hey, stand by a minute, Joe. All of a sudden, my mind's going blank. Go right ahead, sir. WY to you, KQRYW. Tell us what you know about the Wyndham.
Hey, Dick, good evening. This is Mike, Rockville Center. How you doing? WY2U. Yeah, as it turns out, I was kind of half listening, and I was also going, doing some modeling just to see what the dimensions would look like. I think I can give a little bit of a different explanation to what you gave. The modern Carolina Wyndham, the one that I think he's describing, Joe, is an off-center fed antenna that is roughly a half a wavelength long on 80 meters, but fed at the 1.6 ratio point. And it's not fed up there with a balance. Intentionally, it's fed with an unbalanced device. If you want to think of it as being fed with anything that does Well, let's call it a 4-to-1 voltage step up. It's an unbalanced feed. They definitely force unequal currents on the right side and left side of the antenna. Let me drop a minute. Okay, so it's an off-center fed antenna fed with unequal currents on both radiating sections. It's about a half wave on 80, making it a full lambda on 40, 3 lambda on 15, and 4 lambda on 10. So by itself, it would be an antenna that would produce a very scalloped pattern if you wanted to operate it on the higher frequency harmonics. So what they do to mitigate some of those scallops, they actually intentionally put a 22 or a 23-foot vertically polarized radiator fed with normal coax from this 4-to-1 voltage step-up down in a vertical fashion from the center of this antenna, intentionally having the 22-foot vertical section radiate, and that length is approximately, somewhere in the neighborhood of a half a wavelength, I guess, on 20 meters or thereabouts, which fills in the gaps, sort of makes the antenna somewhat more omnidirectional. And then to choke off that vertical section, because you have RF flowing on the shield, they actually, at the 22-foot level, put in a real choke balun to choke off the rest of the feed line. So it is definitely a hybrid antenna, you're quite correct. It's a horizontal radiator with a vertical section that fills in the nulls, and it sort of works very well, and you can get it to work sort of between 80 and 10 meters with almost an omnidirectional pattern. Hope that helps. K2RIW in the group, WI2U.
H2HRO with a question.
HRO recognized, please stand by a minute, sir. Hey, Mike, awful glad you checked in. And you only check in about once a year. You got to check in a little bit more often. The check's in the mail, Mike, Professor Cosma. I believe you do quite a bit of college instructing. And I hope it is an electronic course in wireless technology that you do teach. And awful glad to hear from you, Mike. I wonder, have you taught this exact antenna in some of the classes in the past, either ham radio classes or college classes, Mike? And is this one of the kinds of antennas that, because people don't understand it, it's not super popular, but I think it could be more popular if it was better understood and better explained. I got the latest issue of the AR Oil Antenna book, and I recently bought the RSGB version of some of their antenna books. I don't remember seeing the Windham in there, but maybe I haven't looked at all the chapters yet. Back to you, Professor Cosma. WY2U, K2RAW.
Very good, Dick. Well, I teach electronic communication over at one of the local colleges, Queensboro Community. I teach in the electronic technology curriculum. And yeah, the topic of antennas, as a matter of fact, this one did come up a while ago. We have classes, so to speak, or presentations or tutorials or whatever at the Nassau Amateur Radio Club. And usually, from time to time, members ask questions about various topics, and wireless antennas come up quite a bit, of course. And the Carolina Windome was discussed. One of the gentlemen in the club, I'll be darned if I can remember his call. His first name is Ray. He has an Alpha Bravo 2 call, as I recall, one of the recent ones. And he did build one following the instructions, I think he said, out of the ARRL handbook, although I'm not really sure now. He built it, and he says it works fairly well, and he's pretty happy with it. Anytime anybody builds an antenna, of course, their obligation is to provide a homework assignment and talk to us about all the contacts that he made. And he's fairly happy with the performance. Nobody's ever done a pattern measurement on it, to my knowledge, but he's just basing his assessment on contacts that he worked around the world to. Go ahead.
Good information, Mike, and I thank you. One of the things I wanted to pass to you guys is that I this week purchased a number of books, just decided to go out and buy some books, and I went and bought the Radio Communication Handbook, I think it's what it's called. In other words, we all know what the ARRL Amateur Radio Handbook is, a really fat book with lots and lots of chapters, lots and lots of good information. And the Radio Society of Great Britain has a similar book, which I think is called the Radio Communication Handbook. And it's about 2 inches thick. It's about 10 pounds, very heavy paper, shiny paper. I expected that book to have 75% duplication between the American version and the British version. I expected 75% duplication of articles, techniques, and whatever. My goodness, was I surprised. Wow. I don't think I saw 5% duplication. In other words, 95% of what was in that British handbook is brand new material to me. Different ways of looking at things when it comes to the theory of operation, how the wave radiates, what antennas look like, how to properly feed the antennas, what transmitters look like, what receivers look like, the various modes of propagation, WSJT, how it works. As I said, very different way of looking at things, extremely valuable, well illustrated, and although it's $49 and change, and a big, heavy book, I recommend it. I know it's off subject, but there's lots of different ways of looking at this. None of them are very easy to understand at first. I did hear a check-in from somebody that sounded like K2HRO, but I think I got the call letters incorrect. Please correct me, sir. Tell me your handle, and then tell us your question or comment on this subject. K2HRO, question mark, K2RIW in the TechNet.
10-7 of the new ARRL antenna book, WITU.
Very good. I'll be looking at that.
K2HRO is the call. Name is Joe. And the question has to do with the Wyndham S, which is the subject. Is the vertical balanced line a critical length on that with the 25 and 41 foot wire?
Let's let Dr. Cosma answer that one. WI2U, go right ahead, Joe. Here we go. boy, my bad. Mike, go right ahead with his answer.
I got a correction on that. The vertical section is actually just 50 ohm coax, I gather, with a velocity factor of 0.66 like RG58 or RG8. The dimensions of 22 or 25 feet, as I recall, are simply to allow this antenna to work at a fairly low standing wave ratio for a lot of the cardinal bands without the use of an antenna tuner. Is it supercritical? I suppose it is not. If you're going to use a tuner on it anyway, I'm sure it's not that critical. Again, the dimensions as stated in the literature simply seem to indicate that you'll get a pretty good match if you follow those dimensions on at least the five cardinal bands, Dick. Go ahead.
Thanks an awful lot. Joe, I wonder if that answers your question. And Joe, give me the prefix. I know your suffix is HRO, number two, HR, home, Hotel Romeo Oscar, I am assuming. And what is the prefix? Back to you, Joe.
The call is WB2, William Baker 2. Okay, you said 25 feet vertical coax. Then I guess the short length would be the shield, and then the long length would be the center wire. But what at this 25 foot length down vertically, What transpires at that point before you go the rest of the way into the transmitter?
Very fine, Joe. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, so up at the feed point, again, you've got this off-center fed, I'll call it a dipole, it's not really, but you have this off-center fed radiator with a 4-to-1 voltage step-up matching transformer connecting between the two sections of the off-center fed elements. You come down 25 feet with ordinary coax, RG58 or RG8, depending on the power level, of course, that you want. At the 25-foot point, now you're going to put a real choke type of a balun. You can pile up a number of ferrites, I guess, or you can wind the rest of the coax in some kind of a loop arrangement to act as an RF choke. I gather the impedance at that point, I haven't analyzed it, but it sounds to me like on most bands, the impedance at that point probably is low. On the order of 50 ohms anyway. So probably any kind of a really good choke type of balun probably will choke the RF off the rest of the way. The whole idea, Joe, is that you only want that 22, 25-foot section of vertical coax to radiate, and you don't want the rest of the feed line going back into the shack to radiate. That is what the guts of the antenna are then. You got composite radiation between the two off-center horizontal sections, in conjunction with this 25-foot vertical to more or less give you an omnidirectional pattern. Let's see if that made some sense to you, Joe. WI2U.
WI2U, WB2HRO. Well, very good, because you can make an RF choke, just wind some by 10 turns of, if you're using 58 especially, or 8X, you can wind that very comfortably, put some tie wraps, and you got a choke there, you know? But what about at the top? What kind of transformer do you use at the top? Is it a, or does it, you know, what goes in between the what is it, 41 feet, and I didn't get the other dimension, but, you know, the off-center dipole, for better term.
Oh, okay, yeah, I think it's roughly 50 feet and 80 feet, but somebody can chime in and tell me the exact dimensions. Up there, you're going to use a broadband 4-to-1. Make sure you use a voltage type of balun, not a current balun. The whole idea, Joe, is that you intentionally want to have unequal currents flowing in the two elements to allow line radiation. If you try to symmetrically balance the thing, well, then the vertical section doesn't take the right amount of current ratio. So a 4-to-1 step-up, in other words, you're going to take the 50-ohm impedance of the coax and step it up to about 200 ohms in a voltage fashion, allowing the current to do whatever it has to. That makes sense to you, Joe?
And what do they recommend, a commercial thing, or can you make one?
Either way, a 4-to-1 voltage balun, look in the ARRL antenna handbook under, just go in the glossary under balun. I think there's a number of alternatives. You want to size it up, of course, with the power that you're handling. That'll determine the size of the, if you're going to use a ferrite core or something like that. So size it up for the power. But any of the commercial voltage balun, again, I say voltage, not current. You want to force equal voltages, unequal currents. You can buy them or you can make them. I'm not even sure, Dick, maybe you can help me out here. Who makes these things anymore? Usually I do make my own. Back to next.
Make your own. What do you consist of?
When you roll your own, I am guessing one of the popular techniques of doing it is to start off with the right kind of a toroid ferrite core. In other words, a core that looks like a donut out of the right material, the right size, and you take usually fairly large diameter enameled wire, sometimes twisted pairs, sometimes not. And when you're following the design of a 4-to-1 balun, you're wrapping some number of turns onto that core. And if you've chosen the right core and you do it correctly, it can be a 4-to-1 voltage impedance matching device. In other words, at the input end you see 50 ohms, at the output end you see 200 ohms. And if you do it correctly, it can have rather nice performance from 80 meters down to 10 meters, and maybe even 160. A few of those are guesses on my part, and let's see if Joe agrees with me on these. Mike agrees with me on these, Mike. WY2U, how is that approximately the way you would build it, Mike? K2RIW and the Tech Man?
Yeah, I think so, Dick. That would make sense to me. If you're going to run upwards of, let's say, 300 watts, you probably want to use a fairly large core, like the 2.4-inch OD. Who makes those darn things now? Ferrite, I think, is one of the companies. And the Type 43 material probably would give you pretty good performance down to 3 megahertz. A number of turns of trifilar windings, Joe. In other words, take three wires, heavy gauge, number 16, number 14 wire, twist them together tightly so you got three separate wires. One of those three will form the primary, and then you take one of the two remaining wires for a secondary, and you center tap it. And now you've got one primary wire, one secondary wire center tap connected to the secondary winding, which is a center tap, and to make a voltage balun, I gather all you probably have to do is take the center tap of the secondary and ground it. Let me think about that. Yeah, I think that'll force equal voltages right there. Once you ground that node, you're going to put up a voltage balance point at the center, that would work, which would force equal voltages and unequal currents. I think, Dick, if I'm seeing that right, go ahead.
And that 16-gauge wire you're talking about is enameled wire that you're twisting three leads together. W2FMI, Whiskey 2, Foxtrot, Mike, India, had a whole series of articles on these ferrite core balun-like devices of various impedance matches. Also, Unidella, I think it's a company that was making a number of these. Grinella. Grinella is the name of the guy, I think. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. If you...
Grinella's current, you want reference.
Okay. So, but W2FMI, if you go to the archives of ARRL, and just type in W2FMI, and you look at some of his past articles, roughly 15, 20 years ago, a whole lot of these things were not very expensive in the raw materials, very high in performance. You only had to be a little bit careful in that some of the materials, if you misused them and you overheated them, they would change in their characteristics. He occasionally ran into that problem, but he told you where the minefield was, if you know what I mean. Mr. Civic is his name. I'm having trouble remembering his first name. I'm terrible at names, as you can tell, but Jerry. Oh, what was that again?
Jerry Civic.
Keep IQ with information on the course.
Okay, and here's a magnetic man from way back. Glenn, we're going to get to him in a minute. So, Jerry Civic, Whiskey 2, Fox Mike, India. You do a literature search at ARRL or other places, Google, on those call letters and his name, Jerry Civic, now a silent key, and you're going to find some beautiful articles on how to build these. And as I said, to my knowledge, the materials are not expensive. Homebrewing them gives you a lot of pleasure, a lot of understanding eventually. And Glenn, tell us about the right materials to be used here, Glenn. KC2, QIQ, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the TechNet tonight. I was going to basically high-plex MPP cores. I know Mike before had mentioned using magnetic sink, and magnetic sink makes an MPP high-plex core. And what that core really is it's similar to a ferrite, except it has a distributed air gap. See, the kind of problem that you have with certain cores are, if you're just using ferrite by itself with no air gap inside of it, without any air gap, if there's any small offset in the core in terms of magnetic flux, if it starts walking to one side or the other, the core will saturate and things will start to burn up and your wire goes on fire. So what you're trying to do is find a core that's going to have enough turns on it, so basically that you'll have low enough magnetic flux, but there's still a distributed air gap within the material. The MPP high flux cores are very good. There's also another material that's worth looking into, but the cores, to get the same effect, would have to be a little bit larger. And the other one is called, by magnetic sink, Cool Mu. Cool Mu is another one, very, very excellent core, a little bit easier to get hold of. And one of the reasons I'm mentioning them is that particular style for magnetic sink is it's a lot lower cost core. Some of the MPPs today, because they use nickel and other materials, they get a little bit on the expensive side, Dick. Back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
And both Joe and Joe, as you can tell, Glenn has been working with these magnetic materials so much that the words come spilling out of his mouth so fast that to him he's highly familiar. When he talks about magnetic sink, it is Magnetics Incorporated. He's saying it very fast. So that's the name of the company. And you go to that website, Magnetics Incorporated, you'll see some beautiful information on their materials, ways of using it, and how these things work. As you can tell, this antenna, the modern embodiment of this antenna, which was probably invented, I'm going to pick out a year, 1945 or so, nothing is simple. When it comes to the very first time you hear all of this, some of this material you guys are hearing for the first time is going to scare you a little bit. And if you feel uncomfortable because you're hearing it for the first time, you're in good company. Don't feel bad. Hang in there. And the antenna is probably worth fighting for because it's a lot simpler than some of the others. I prefer a fan dipole, but that's just me. There's other ways of getting multiple bands of the antenna. So, hey, Joe, you've opened up quite a subject tonight, the first show. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Will it be Magnetic Products Incorporated or Magnetic Incorporated?
That's you, Glenn. What's the full name of the company? And if there's another company, go slow and give us the name so that we can find it on the website. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
The home branch for the company is in Pennsylvania, and it's called Magnetics, Inc., or Magnetics Incorporated. Sometimes it's also called Mag Inc. I think if you probably were to Google any one of those three, Magnetics, Inc., Mag Inc., you'll pretty much come up with the corporation. Just make sure that their home office is in Pennsylvania. You got the right people. KC2QIQ.
Thank you, Glenn. And look what you started, Joe. The K2IYY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, I see one in California. It's Magnetic Incorporated.
Joe, RYY, go right ahead.
Keep the people like you thinking. I always like bringing good questions to TechNet, Dick. Thanks a lot. You know what it is? I'm like you. I don't know whether I want to put up a fan dipole. I've been talking to another ham friend of mine, N2VOA. He's swaying toward putting up a Carolina Wyndham. He says, oh, they're great, they work great. So I want to just find out more about it. That's why I brought the question up on the deck net. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Joe. Hang in there and keep asking these crazy questions and keep us on our toes. Bernie, you're next. K2 Mike Uniform. How are things going with you, Bernie? And I heard a little bit of your conversations earlier today or yesterday. I got a guess as to what we're going to get into tonight. You got it, Bernie. K2 Mike Uniform, K2 RIW and the TechNet.
Can I just add one more thing to the balance before you go to the next subject?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think building balance is a fun thing to do, but it can be a little bit on the discouraging side. Sometimes buying a very well-built, commercially available one first and seeing how it operates so that you have something to compare to is always a good way to go. And the way I talk about this company, you think I have stock in them, but RF Engineering is a great company to look at, and sometimes buying one, from them, and then they give you all the power ratings, they give you the full data sheets on them and everything. It's really wonderful pieces of gear. I own a few of them, and even though I built and designed my own balance stick, but back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, you come from the commercial world. We're buying them, writing the check, making the problem go away is a very easy, beautiful solution. If I went to RF Engineering or Magnetic Ink or whatever, if I bought the final product that operates from, say, 3.5 megacycles and possibly as high as 30 megacycles included, and can do so at 100 watt power level, maybe later on I'm going to go to the 500 watt power level, if I went and wrote the check and bought the thing outright, fully weatherproofed and ready to roll, roughly how many dollars we're talking about? If it was $30, I'd write the check and the problem goes away. If it's $300, I'm going to want to build it. That's just me. Back to you, Glenn, on that one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
A really nice 2.5 kW monster that you can put on the back of a nice kilowatt amplifier is going to probably cost about 100.5. And the nice thing about that is that it is a 160 meter to 10 meter full operation. Some of them will even go as high as 6. There's another nice feature about them too. We really didn't talk about them a lot earlier. Is that to build a balun on one band is easy. To build one to go across 10 through 160. That separates the boys from the men, Dick. Back to you.
Just remember, folks, you want a voltage balun, not a current balun.
You beat your HRO question. The guy what said fan dipole. That's the simpler way, right?
And that's Joe number two. In my opinion, the answer is yes, Joe, HRO. In the case of a fan dipole, what makes it so magic is that for us to string some extra pieces of wire up in the air, fairly simple. The first question the average guy asks when he's building a fan dipole is, hey, those tips, how far are they going to be separated? And there is no magic there. If you're building a fan dipole for 80, 40, 20, and 10, so to speak, the 80-meter dipole doesn't care about all the other dipoles. It doesn't see them. The 40-meter dipole, the tips of it, sees the extra capacitance between those tips in the middle of the 80-meter dipole halves. And that added capacitance tunes it a little bit lower in frequency. Therefore, the 40-meter fan dipole, you make it a little bit shorter for your particular spacing to bring it back to resonance. And by plotting standing wave ratio versus frequency, you get the U-shaped curve and the bottom of the U. And if it's a little bit above 7.2 megs, if that's your favorite frequency, you've made it too short. If it's a little bit too long, it's going to tune at 6.9 or 7.0, so it's easy to recorrect. To adjust the length. And once you're willing to adjust the length, the magic of that fan dipole is that it automatically does all of the switching. When you're on 40 meters, the 40-meter dipole gives you a 70-ohm impedance, so to speak, and 90-some-odd% of the power flows into that one. The 80-meter dipole, when you're feeding 40-meter energy into it, is a 3,000-ohm capacitive reactance. It is so close to an open circuit that no power flows down it. But even if a little bit did, who cares? It's being radiated, and so on. So, the nice thing about a fan dipole is that you're tuning individual bands all by themselves
When you're tuning that 40-meter dipole, you're not doing anything to the 80-meter dipole. When you're tuning the 20-meter dipole, you're not doing anything to the 40-meter dipole, and so on.